It was a packed house at the Watering Hole Bar in Green Bay, Wisconsin on May 20th, 2016. Doug Dietry and his girlfriend, Nicole Vanderhaden, decided to join their friends to watch the band Steel Panther perform.
Everybody was having fun.
Were you drinking that night?
Yes, I was.
Was Nikki drinking that night?
Yep.
The couple got split up after the band ended. Nikki decided to go with Doug's group of friends to the next bar while she waited for him to catch up to them. They arrived at the Sardine Can Bar around 10 p.m.
She was drunk, feeling good, kind of happy, and that's about it.
Doug still hadn't arrived by the time the group wanted to leave around 12:20 a.m. One of the friends called an Uber ride home. Doug wasn't picking up Nikki's phone calls, but he finally answered when another friend, Angela, called him. Angela hung up with Doug and called him a loser. Nikki, baffled that he had picked up the call for Angela and not her, started walking down the street. Aaron Kamensky went to go talk to her, but when Nikki saw that he was following, she took off running.
I got in front of her to try to, console her a little bit, and she just became combative and kind of pushing me away, and then I continued a little longer, but then she kind of did like this dead weight thing and fell to the ground, was continuing to cry and kind of hitting me in my legs and stuff.
She was striking at you?
She was striking at me, screaming at the top of her lungs.
Aaron told Nikki he just wanted to help her get home to her six-month-old baby boy, Dylan, whom she had had with Doug. The two had been dating for about a month when Nikki found out she was pregnant. They were living together and raising Dylan as a couple. By this time, the Uber had arrived. Aaron and the other girls got into it. But Nikki continued walking, crossing the street and turning down another. Meanwhile, Doug's friend, Greg, drove him around to look for her, but they couldn't find her. They continued to call, text, and Snapchat her, but Nikki didn't answer. Doug returned home around 2:40 a.m.
Drunk and tired. I had quite a bit to drink that night, and I was just kind of exhausted of, not being able to get a hold of Nikki, kind of frustrated and tired.
Nikki didn't come home the next morning, and none of her friends or family had heard from her. In the afternoon, when she still hadn't returned, Doug called 911 to file a missing persons report. Earlier in the day, a farmer out with his grandsons made a gruesome discovery in a wooded field.
When we went in between there, there was a wooden fence post laying in the field that I got off and picked it up and just threw it over the hill. And then I was kind of looking, and I said, the boys were further that way from me. I said, is that a dead deer down there? And they were looking at it different. From the angle they were at, they could see perfect. They said, no, that's a body. And then I told them to get the hell out of there.
Who was the last person to see Nikki that night? What happened to this young mother? Why hadn't she come home? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 116. Doug Dietry officially reported Nikki as missing around 4:30 p.m. on May 21st, 2016. Two officers came to his house to speak with him. He described Nikki as a great mother to their six-month-old and to her two other children from her previous marriage. He said she had only been out a handful of times since delivering Dylan and wasn't used to drinking. So this isn't normal behavior for her? One of the officers asked Doug. Not at all, Doug replied. Doug agreed to let the officers look at his phone while Nikki's sister Heather looked at Nikki's phone account to see where she had been. They could only tell that she had been to the two bars that night.
We had the news on, and then I think it was a 9 or 10 o'clock news, and all of a sudden there was a woman's body was found in Bellevue, like Brule or something like that, and it was this, everybody's emotions were
At that point, did you become more concerned that perhaps
very concerned at that point. I didn't know what to think. I was trying to stay positive, but then I was like, oh my God, that could be her.
The officers returned to Doug's house around midnight and asked if he could give more information on the missing persons report. Doug agreed and rode in the police car back to the station.
Yeah, after they asked some, you know, characteristics of Nikki and everything, and they said, you know, that there was some similarities or something, a lot of similarities, but they couldn't confirm that it was Nikki, that the body that they had found, and I don't know, it was something on that order, and I had a lot going through my mind at that point, and it was...
How did that make you feel when you heard that?
Devastated, shocked, I don't know, I was just a lot going through my mind. I was just so puzzled and shocked and hurt, sad. I mean, it's a whirlwind of emotions.
Doug gave the officers his pants and shoes he was wearing. He had been wearing them the night before at the concert, too. He said he would go talk to every person on the street who may have seen her. The officers pressed Doug, asking him if he was involved. Doug said no. The next day, a detective asked him for a sample of his DNA. He said no and told them they would have to get a warrant. Lead investigator Sergeant Brian Slinger did just that and continued to search for more evidence.
Well, at that time, I had information that it was a blunt force trauma. Sergeant Lopnow and I had been in communications. He was down with the crime lab and he had witnessed the body. So we were looking for any sort of items that may have caused that damage. Like stated earlier, there's a lot of rocks and a lot of things like that in the field that could potentially have been used. So we were looking through those rocks to see if there may have been any blood or any other sorts of evidence on any of those rocks.
On the morning of May 21st, the day after Nikki's disappearance, one of Doug's neighbors was out mowing the lawn when he noticed a piece of cord had gotten stuck in his lawnmower. Matthew Peterson picked up the cord, looked at it, and put it aside. That's when he noticed there was a large pool of blood on his curb. At the time, he thought a deer or some other large animal may have been killed. But 2 days later, on May 23rd, when his wife told him about Nikki's murder, he contacted the police. Detective Slinger obtained search warrants for Doug and Nikki's house, vehicles, and for different Facebook, Gmail, and Snapchat accounts. Nikki had a herringbone zigzag pattern on her back, believed to be consistent with the bottom of Air Jordan shoes. And they found shoes in Doug and Nikki's garage that they thought could have been a match, with suspected blood on them. They also found other areas of suspected blood as well.
Up until that night, or I'm sorry, up until Monday night, the 23rd, we really weren't sure where Nicole was killed. Obviously, we knew where the body was located. Monday night, we had this crime scene close proximity to their residence. At the time, we had known about this herringbone pattern that was on her back. I knew that these shoes were found in the garage, which had about 5 or 6 red stains on the bottom that appeared to be possibly could have been blood. We also had some blood in the garage that was located near Miss Vanderheiden's vehicle was, that was presumptively tested for blood. And then looking at the photographs of Miss Vanderheiden's vehicle, it appeared that there was a lot of smudges, there was a lot of stains that may have been consistent with blood. So at that time, we had thought that that vehicle was potentially used to transport her body.
An off-duty officer reported finding clothing along a highway ramp about 2 miles from where Nikki's body was located. They also found her bra, purse, and cell phone. Doug Dietry was arrested and taken into custody. He was booked into the Brown County Jail and held on a $1 million bond. More than 200 pieces of evidence were sent into the state's crime lab. 18 days later, the results were in. The blood in the garage wasn't human. The blood in the bathroom was from Nikki's sister getting a nosebleed. The stains on the shoes weren't actually blood at all. The blood in the car wasn't Nikki's, and vehicle information showed that the car hadn't moved that night at all.
So all these pieces of evidence that we thought we had, turned out to be, have answers for them. And I'd also add that during that time, I was in contact with Kevin Scott, and he was advising me of this consistent unknown male Y profile that was coming up on the items that we were sending to the lab that was not consistent with Mr. Dietrich's.
Doug also said he had an alibi. In an undercover video taken by officers at his home when he initially filed the missing persons report, Doug can be seen wearing a Fitbit. He claimed he never took it off, except to charge it for an hour or so. Data from the Fitbit revealed that Doug's movements were consistent with his statements to police. So after 18 days in jail, Doug was released. Detective Slinger was essentially now back at square one. He knew he had one large unanswered question. How did Nikki get home that night? On the night of May 20th, Nikki sent a text message to Doug saying, "Good thing I found someone." Detective Slinger went back to video surveillance from the sardine can to try to identify who that person was. That man was identified and agreed to give a DNA sample. He was eliminated as the unknown male profile found on Nikki's body. More potential persons of interest were identified. Nikki's ex-husband, son, and the other men who had been with her at the bars were all eliminated. Detective Slinger wasn't having any luck either with canvassing for surveillance video that may have caught Nikki getting into a car in the area. About 3 months after Nikki's death, there was finally a break in the case.
Yeah, so on August 19th, 2016, Kevin Scott had called me and told me that one of the recent items that we had sent into the lab for analysis, a sock that was taken off of Nikki's body, he was able to extract a DNA sample from that sock that he then entered into a DNA database, so to speak, and he was able to get a DNA match.
And who was the individual that Mr. Scott advised that match was for?
He advised me that it was for a George Stephen Birch.
George Stephen Birch was a 38-year-old man from Virginia. It appeared he had no known connection to Nikki or Doug. But a search in a national database found that his DNA was a match to DNA found on a sock that was taken off Nikki's body. Court records revealed that George Birch had been convicted 5 times in the past, and he was involved in a report of a vehicle fire in the city of Green Bay on June 8, 2016, just a few weeks after Nikki's death. According to a police report, a responding Green Bay officer believed that a red Chevy Blazer, which belonged to a couple that George had been living with, had been involved in a hit-and-run accident the night before. The Blazer had now been destroyed in a fire, and according to the owners, George had been the last one to drive it. George said he wasn't involved in the hit and run, that he must have left the keys in the car, and it had been stolen. He said he had been texting his friend at a bar and agreed to give his phone to officers to corroborate his alibi. The hit and run case was then closed because it was impossible to tell if George had been driving the Blazer. The cause of the vehicle fire was unknown, but possibly could have been from damage due to the accident. Detective Slinger began to surveil George, worrying that he may flee if he learned he was a suspect in Nikki's murder. On September 7th, 2016, George Birch was arrested for the first-degree murder of Nicole Vanderhayden. On February 19, 2018, George Birch went to trial. Prosecutor David Lassie gave opening statements on behalf of the state.
The citizens of Brown County value few things more than they value their personal security. To think that something like this could happen in our community to anyone at any time is horrifying. this particular night, it wasn't a full banner act. Any other night, it could happen in the village of Bellevue, the city of Decatur, the town of Bellevue, that a violent, ruthless killer could do what we believe the evidence would show Mr. Burke did.
He said that Nikki was a 31-year-old mother of three who worked as a substitute teacher. She was a friendly soul with a lot of life to live. Her life ended far too soon for no clear reason. The defense said they have a different version of events, that Nikki's death was not a random act of violence. Rather, the defense promised that they would be able to identify Nikki's true killer.
The evidence is going to show that the right result is a verdict of not guilty. Yes, the evidence will show that George's DNA, significant amounts of George's DNA, were on various pieces of evidence in this case, including on Nicole's body. The evidence is going to show that George's cell phone went to these various locations. He was with Nicole. The evidence is going to show you there was sexual contact. But at the end of the trial, you will have a completely innocent explanation that ties all of this evidence together.
The state called a series of witnesses to put together a timeline of Nikki's last known whereabouts. Greg Matthew has been friends with Doug for more than 20 years. He said he met Nikki in 2015, not long after Doug and Nikki started dating. He said Steel Panther is one of his favorite bands, and it was his idea to go to the concert that night. He explained to the jury how he and Doug got split up from the rest of their friends.
As you watched Doug and Nikki interact, did you draw any conclusions about how they're getting along?
I mean, I thought everybody was having a great time.
At some point in time, did you and Doug run into some woman that you knew from your earlier school years?
Katie Jones was a good friend of mine. I hadn't seen her since she got married. She got married to Paul Hanna. He's the lead singer of Annex. I hadn't seen her since that time, and she's a close friend of mine that I've also known for 20 years, and we saw her at one point and talked to her for some period of time at the end of the concert.
Was she with anyone?
Her husband, you know, he was there, but we, you know, we wanted to meet him and congratulate him, and, you know, he never ended up coming up to where we were. So, I mean, it was clearing out at that time, so there were a lot of people. The bathroom lines got incredibly long. I was in the line. I got into the bathroom, and when I came out, I saw that Doug was, you know, a ways back in the line, and I told him that I would give him a ride. At that time, I didn't see our friends there.
Meanwhile, back at the sardine can, the group of friends were ready to go home. Aaron was trying unsuccessfully to get Nikki to go with them.
I just yelled, "We could get you home faster to your child and what you're doing." And I yelled, "You're a babe in the woods."
Did she turn around and respond to that?
No, she didn't.
Did she answer you in any way?
Nope.
What did you do then?
I could hear the girls yelling that our ride is here. So I'm looking at Nikki and hearing the girls, and I retreat back.
The last time you saw her then, where was she?
She was walking down Maple.
Greg and Doug headed over to the sardine can around 12:20, having just missed their friends and Nikki. Greg had received Adderall from a friend earlier that night. He and Doug took it in the parking lot when they left the bar, hoping it would help stop the effects of the alcohol. Greg drove and Doug left his car at the watering hole. Doug was on the phone with Nikki, and Greg could tell she was upset. Greg asked to speak to Nikki himself and told her he would pick her up wherever she was.
She made a comment that she didn't believe it was me, that it was Doug playing a trick on her, which I said, "Nikki, you know, it's me. I'll pick you up wherever you are." And at that point, her phone shut off. I don't believe she hung up on me. I believe the battery died. It wasn't like she was, you know, angry and hung up. I think her battery died. Doug continued to try to call her back with no success.
They continued to drive around looking for Nikki. On cross, Greg said Doug could be perceived as a drunk asshole at times when he drank.
Do you know where Doug worked?
He works for his parents. Petrie Construction.
Do you know where he was working in May of 2016?
I would imagine Petrie Construction.
So you didn't know at that time Doug was not working because he was having issues with Nikki?
No, I was not aware of that.
You weren't aware that the serious issues led him to quit working because the relationship was in a fall?
He already said he wasn't aware, and this is definitely assuming facts, not in evidence.
The objection was sustained. Greg said he wasn't aware of any relationship issues between Doug and Nikki. He said they continued to search for Nikki to see if she was walking home. They arrived at Doug's house around 2:45 a.m. The babysitter, Dallas Kennedy, was asleep on the couch. She woke up when she heard Doug and Greg come home. Dallas said she was friends with Nikki from previously working at a restaurant together and had agreed to watch Dylan to give Nikki and Doug a night out. She said when the two men got home, she talked to them for about 20 minutes.
Doug immediately asked if I had heard from Nikki. I was confused as because I would hear other footsteps, and I said, "Isn't she with you?" And he said, "No, that's my friend Greg." And then he trailed in shortly after. And I was just scared because, again, I've never conversated with Doug and I've never met Greg. So me being in their home and just her not being around, I went to grab my clothes immediately by the kitchen table. And Greg repeatedly paced back and forth in the hallway and then went to the fridge to grab something to eat. Doug kind of chimed in with, "You're hungry?" And he grabbed a Go-Gurt at the time and ate that.
Dallas said they seemed very concerned. Greg left and Dallas helped Doug brainstorm over where Nikki could be. She said she called Nikki several times while she was at the house, and Doug asked her to call Nikki again while she was driving home, and then again the next morning. The state called Doug Dietrich to the stand. He talked about meeting Nikki and the two hitting it off instantly. He said she was a very good mother to Dylan and to her two other children from her first marriage. The two lived with them during the week and would stay with their father on the weekends. He said they had plans to get married once Dylan was older and raise their family together. On May 20th, while at the Sardine Can, Doug received a flurry of angry text messages from Nikki about 20 minutes after they were separated. Around midnight, Nikki texted Doug, quote, "So what bitch you with?" She continued with her flurry of angry texts. "Fuck you, abusive asshole. Wow, what slut are you with? Because none of your friends know. I am not surprised. How many times have your dick been off for some whore?"
I was kind of puzzled. I didn't know what she was thinking or I didn't know what was going on, you know.
Doug texted her, "LOL, are you kidding? What's going on here?" Nikki replied, "Sure, you still love whores." Doug responded, "Yup, I learned lots." He then wrote, "LOL, stop it, Nikki. I'll be there soon." Nikki wrote, "You hurt me all the time." Doug then wrote, "Nikki, call me."
Why did you not respond in a vulgar or upset way?
Well, I wasn't upset, and I think I just kind of thought she was upset for an unknown reason, and that there wasn't really a reason for it.
Doug said he kept trying to call her, but her phone went straight to voicemail. He said that he wasn't particularly concerned at first because she was an adult and could take care of herself, but he grew worried when she hadn't come home from the bar later that night. Doug said he woke up around 6:30 in the morning to feed Dylan. He took a selfie with Dylan and sent it to Nikki using Snapchat, hoping he could tell if she opened the photo. She never did. He and Dylan fell asleep again. He woke up around 11 a.m., fed Dylan again, and made himself some mac and cheese. He started contacting friends and family and filed the missing persons report later that day. Records from Doug's Fitbit data showed his movements were consistent with this. 2 days later, he was taken into custody. Doug described what was going through his head when he was arrested.
Just like, I don't know. I was like, why, how am I in this position? You know, what's going on? I didn't get it. I think I said to him that this is wrong. I was told not to, I was advised not to say anything. And I wanted to say so many things, you know, I had nothing to do with this. You guys are making a big mistake here. And
they informed you that you were under arrest and that it was for what they believe was the murder of Nikki Vanderheide.
Yes.
Doug, when was the last time that you personally saw Nikki alive?
It was, I think it was right after the show. I don't even really recall. I think it was right when we were going to the bathroom and said I was going to the bathroom. And just a little, going to the bathroom and see you in 10 minutes, whatever, you know. And it's the last time I saw her.
On cross, Doug said there were times when he would get upset with Nikki and thought about breaking up with her. When asked, Doug said he had never cheated on Nikki. So then why was she sending him text messages accusing him of doing so?
Doug, the text messages didn't just talk about infidelity. They also talked about abuse. For instance, the one that was already read to you, fuck you, abusive asshole. That would be number 4. And then number 30 that Nikki sent to you, she said you hurt me all the time. Did you hurt Nikki that night?
Do you mean physically or what? No, I mean...
Did you physically beat her in the past?
No, I never physically beat Nikki.
So you just have no idea why she would say these things?
Exactly. I have no idea where that was coming from. That's why it was so puzzling to me. I think I was telling Greg or whatever. I'm like, what's Nikki talking about here?
Doug said he has a concealed carry permit and owns a shotgun and a rifle. He also said Nikki had walked off in the past. They had watched a Packers game at a bar once when Nikki walked out upset without her coat on. He said he waited to call police until 4:30 p.m. on May 21st because he was hoping that she would have slept off whatever made her angry and would come back home.
And that's 17 hours since you last saw her.
Yeah, I think so, yep.
And that's also after her body was already found.
Yeah, at that time, you know, and afterwards I did, yeah, that would be after.
And that's after a large police buildup off Hoffman Road.
Yeah, I was unaware of that police buildup until well after the fact.
And then you made sure that before police arrived, you took a shower.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I was feeling grubby and, you know.
You wanted to
needed to wake up and.
You wanted to hide any proof that you were involved in her murder. So you took a shower before the police came.
Doug said he didn't know he was a suspect in Nikki's murder until he was being arrested. According to an autopsy by the county medical examiner, Nikki's death was a homicide caused by ligature strangulation and blunt force trauma. She suffered 241 injuries, including significant facial injuries, a fractured jaw, and injuries of the genitalia suggestive of sexual assault. They were listed as substantial, repeated injuries. Dr. Agnieszka Rogalska listed 2 causes of death, and here's why. Quote, there are injuries inside and on the neck muscles that we haven't discussed that are consistent with her being alive at the time of the ligature being placed around her neck. So I know she was alive when that happened. But I also know she was alive at the time that the head injury occurred. So I can't say which one of those happened first and which one was the final one. Therefore, that's why they're both listed. Each of them is fatal in this environment. Dr. Rogalska determined that the cord found on Doug's neighbor's lawn is consistent with the ligature marks on Nikki's neck. The Wisconsin State Crime Laboratory confirmed Nikki's DNA was on the cord, and the blood found in the road was indeed hers. Two men jogging on the road on the morning of May 21st would later tell police they noticed the pool of blood around 5:45. Nikki's body was swabbed for DNA in areas investigators believed the killer would have touched in order to drag her body into the field. An unknown male's DNA was found on key parts of her body, including on her chest, arms, hands, under her fingernails, and vagina. The same male profile was also found on the cord. They were able to find a sample large enough to submit to the national database on Nikki's sock. The hit was a match for George Stephen Birch. In fact, George's DNA was found on a total of 16 different places on Nikki's body. Detective Slinger obtained a search warrant for George's Google account information associated with his Samsung cell phone. A forensic download of his Google dashboard revealed that he started his night on May 20th at Richard Cranium's bar, a short distance from the Sardine Can. He stayed there until 2:30 a.m., when he went home from 2:32 a.m. until 2:38 a.m. He then drove down Broadway on the west side of Green Bay, crossed the bridge, and arrived at Nikki's house at 3:01 a.m. His cell phone remained in front of the home until 3:53 a.m. From 3:58 through 4:02 a.m., George's cell phone pings off at the field where Nikki's body is found. At 4:05 a.m., his phone pings on the highway, near the ramp where her clothes and purse were found. At 4:22 a.m., George went home and remained there until the morning. He was woken up by his friend, Ed Jackson, to go on a fishing trip. George had moved from Virginia to Green Bay in March 2016. Ed Jackson had offered him a place to stay and helped him find a job.
On May 21st, at any point in time, either before you left your house, in the car, or on the boat with the defendant, did you notice any injuries to his head?
No.
Did you have a good view of his head during that time period?
Yes.
Didn't see any bruising?
No.
No swelling?
No.
No abrasions?
No.
No contusions?
No.
And he had no hat on for that time period you were on the boat?
No hat.
Ed said that George didn't mention anything about what he was up to the night before. When they returned home, they were watching the local news when a story about a local homicide came on. Ed said, "The scumbag that did it ought to be taken down." George didn't reply, but was intently watching the news. The defense had their turn to call witnesses. They decided to recall Dallas Kennedy, the babysitter, to the stand. She was asked about a phone call between her and Doug 2 days after Nikki was killed.
Just kind of going over that we were both in the investigator's office. And he basically had stated that that was her body that they had found and that she had passed. And basically in conversation, I just asked, what happened? You know, like, what happened? And he just replied, I don't know. She hit her head and then she just wanted to walk home. She just wanted to walk home. Just in a conversation. It was just conversation between two people of just in shock. I asked if he was with family and that he should just be with his family right now. And if he needed anything, reach out later, but kind of grieve with your family.
So specifically, when you had asked him what happened, he said, I don't know, she hit her head, correct?
It came out of his mouth, that comment. I don't know what that meant, but it came out of his mouth.
Dallas said the conversation ended shortly after that statement. She also said Doug asked her for weed to smoke after he came home from the bar while she was watching Dylan. He smoked that night, but she did not. As the defense stated in their opening statements, they would present a different version of events of how the night unfolded, other than what the prosecution put forward. And in order to do so, the defendant, George Birch, was called to the stand to testify.
Hey, George.
How you doing?
Good. You've been sitting here for a long time.
Yes, sir.
Probably have a lot you want to explain to the jury.
Yes, sir.
Let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
George said he was born in Hampton, Virginia, which is also known as Newport News. He was adopted when he was a week old and never met his biological parents. He said his nickname since he was 6 years old is Big Country, and otherwise he goes by Steve. He was married with two children and said in 2015, when he was going through a divorce, sat his kids down and told them he was moving to Wisconsin. His kids were, quote, 100% behind him with whatever he needed to do. He moved into Ed and Linda Jackson's home and then started working as a line cook. He felt he was working too hard there and got a new job working in landscaping. He would frequent the Green Bay Bar, Richard Cranium's, which was just 3 blocks away from the Jackson's home. According to George, on the morning of May 20th, 2016, he woke up around 5 a.m. He went to his landscaping job during the day and then had dinner at a restaurant with Ed and a couple friends. Afterwards, they went to the mall so George could set up his cell phone. They went to a friend's house to get supplies for their fishing trip the next day. Around 11 p.m., George arrived by himself at Richard Cranium's. The bartender had his favorite drink, a Jack and Coke, waiting for him. George said he struck up a conversation with an attractive blonde woman who appeared to be alone.
I was flirting.
And how was she acting towards you?
Somewhat the same, pretty much. Flirting back and forth with each other.
So I guess tell me more about that if you remember. I mean, what, if you remember, gave you the impression that you were flirting with her and she was flirting with you?
Well, I moved a little closer to her, just talking, laughing, joking, giggling, light touch here or there, just things that you can pretty much tell if someone's kind of into you, I guess would be the best way to put it.
George said they were there until the bar closed. He invited Nikki back to his place, and he said she gave him the impression that she agreed. They left in his SUV. When they arrived back at his house, George said Ed's elderly father was awake, so he felt like they couldn't stay there. Nikki used the bathroom at the house, and then she asked to go back to her place. He said she gave him directions as he was driving. She asked him to pull over on Berkeley Road. George said Nikki saw there was a light on at her home and thought her babysitter was still up. He said they sat in the car and started talking and, quote, fooling around.
Kissing. I was kissing her neck a little bit, touching each other.
Did you guys stay in the front seat?
No, sir.
Where'd you go?
The back seat, the Blazer.
How did you get into the back seat?
I got out of the driver's side and walked around to the back passenger.
Do you remember how she got in the back seat?
I don't remember if she got out, hopped in the back, or she just climbed over into the back seat.
George said things started to escalate while they were in the back seat and their clothes started coming off. He's a big guy and there wasn't a ton of room for him, so he opened the back passenger door to stand outside. He said Nikki remained inside while lying on her back, and they proceeded to have what he described as not gentle intercourse.
The next thing that I remember, apart from us having intercourse, was literally waking up on the ground outside the truck, laying in the grass curb area.
I just want to make sure I get you correctly. So you remember having intercourse, and then you remember waking up on the ground.
Right.
You don't remember, I guess, any in-between time there?
No, sir.
George said he remembers 1 minute having intercourse, and the next, waking up lying on the ground, perpendicular to the car. He said he looked around to try to get his bearings. He went to grab his pants and realized someone was standing behind him.
The first thing I heard was, don't even fucking think about it. was the first things I ever heard, the first words I heard. It was fairly dark. I saw someone that looked like a hooded sweatshirt. Couldn't really see any faces, just glimpse. Standing behind me, it looked like it was like in this direction, and which appeared to be a firearm in his hand.
George said he saw a man standing about 10 feet behind him, holding a handgun. He pulled his pants up and was instructed to move towards the back of the vehicle. He considered running, screaming, or trying to attack. He noticed something behind the truck and realized it was Nikki, laying on her back with blood coming out of her mouth. He couldn't tell if she was alive or dead, but she wasn't moving. He said the man behind him was saying, "Look what the fuck you made me do." The man made him pick Nikki up to put her into the vehicle. George said the man remained behind him, pointing a gun. He was told to shut the door and then get into the driver's seat.
Pretty much forceful, let me know that this is what I want you to do and you're going to do it. And in a way, I guess, would be the best way to put it.
Was he loud?
Wasn't extremely loud. But more of a, I guess maybe it was like a commanding tone. Like, let me know that he was speaking to me and what he meant everything that he was telling me to do.
He said the man got into the back seat behind him. When George looked in his rearview mirror, he was finally able to see the man's face.
At that point, did you know who that individual was?
Never seen him before in my life.
Do you know who that individual is now?
Now I do.
Who was it?
It was Doug Dietrich.
Doug Dietrich. George said he was told to turn the vehicle around. He reached up to put his seatbelt on and the man said, "Don't even fucking think about it." The man nudged him and instructed him where to drive. Eventually, he turned onto a dirt road into a wooded field. He carried Nikki's body for a while, but was unable to hold her arms and legs at the same time. And he dropped her.
At this time, when I seen him kind of look away or not pay direct attention to me, was when I kind of went like this to draw his attention more to what was going on than to me. And when I did, Nicole kind of flipped over like this way. Her feet were more ahead of her and flipped over. And when he kind of paid attention to what was going on at that time, that's when I turned and with everything I had, I lunged at him and pushed him as hard as I possibly could at that time.
Did he fall down?
I don't know. He stumbled backwards. Did he fall down? I don't know. Because I broke for it.
What'd you do?
Hauled ass to my car. Or my truck.
George said he jumped in his vehicle and tried to take off. He pushed on the gas, realized he wasn't in drive, got into gear, and then hauled out of there. He said he lit a cigarette and drove home using the directions on his phone. He looked over and saw some of Nikki's things still in the car. He freaked out and threw them out the window. He went home, showered, and washed his clothes to get the blood off. He noticed a bump on his head that was sore. He said he passed out from overwhelming exhaustion. He woke up the next morning to Ed saying it was time to go fishing. He said he was too scared to call 911 because he was on probation for grand larceny.
Why didn't you tell Ed?
I don't know why I didn't say anything. I don't know if it was just where I'm from. You don't talk. You don't tell about things you've seen. You don't tell on people. People get killed all the time where I'm from for that. And I feared for my own safety if I would have ever said anything, because like I said, where I'm from, it happens all the time. People go to telling people and tell things and they end up dead. They never make it to court. They never make it anywhere. They find them dead.
He said he followed the case on the news. He felt he didn't need to come forward because the police had already arrested Doug. He didn't know that Doug had been released until he himself was arrested.
George, did you murder Nicole Vanderheide?
No, sir. Definitely not.
Do you know who did?
Doug Dietrich.
The state began cross-examining George by questioning him on his inconsistencies. He was asked how the jury was to believe that he followed the case closely on the news, but only learned that Doug was released from jail from the investigators who arrested him.
You had every intention of having sex with Nicole that night, correct?
I was hoping that was the way it was going. That's the way it seemed like it was leading, yes, sir.
Did Nicole tell you that she had a young baby at home, that she was a nursing mother?
I believe she had said something about it. The nursing part, I'm not sure. I do believe she said she had had a child because she had mentioned to me that she had a babysitter.
I thought she told you that the kids were out of town with their dad.
I said those too, but I also said when we got there, the light was on. She said the babysitter was up.
Why would that be a problem? Why wouldn't you just ask the babysitter to go home and go inside?
Sir, I don't know. I've never been in her house. I don't know her babysitter.
So Nicole would rather have sex with you in front of her neighbor's home with your butt hanging out the door of the car than ask the babysitter to go home?
Sir, I don't know. I wasn't the one making decisions.
Next, the state asked about autopsy findings presented in court, the vaginal trauma and bleeding that Nikki suffered, the contusions to her genital area, painful injuries to her breast areas, a fractured jaw.
When you get there and it becomes clear that Nikki isn't going to have sex with you, when she attempts to go into her house and leave your vehicle, that's when your mood changes, right?
No, sir.
That's when things get aggressive, don't they?
Not at all.
That's when you grab that cord and strangle her, don't you?
No, sir, not at all.
That's when Nikki gets slammed on the ground repeatedly when she's trying to run toward her house, when those bloodstains lead in a direction back to her home.
None of that is true.
Well, how do you know? You were out cold when Nikki was assaulted.
Because you said I did it.
Prosecutor Lassie asked George if he expected the jury to believe that Doug did all of these things to his girlfriend while he was out cold on the ground. Why would Doug think it was a good idea for a stranger to help him dump his girlfriend's body? And instead of holding on to Nikki's clothes and purse to give to the police as evidence, why did he throw them onto the side of the road?
You didn't know, right? You don't know whose DNA is on those clothes. You don't know what's not on those clothes. Instead of holding on to those clothes and bringing them in and explaining your story to the sheriff's office, you toss them out your window?
I spazzed out. I freaked out. I was trying to do it. I wasn't thinking clearly at the time, to be completely honest. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to do. I've never been in a situation like that before, sir.
Is that true?
Is what true, sir? I've never been in a situation where I was made to carry a body. No, sir, I haven't.
George had previously been found not guilty of murder in Virginia of a man who was shot to death in a gang-related killing in 1997.
Just to clarify, your version of the events, you're assaulted, you're held at gunpoint, you carried the mangled body of a woman to her final resting place, and the next day, you're going fishing with your buddy, with a smile on your face and not a care in the world.
It was a pre-planned event, sir, and I wouldn't say not a care in the world. That would definitely would not be something I would say.
No further questions.
The defense had no redirect.
Nikki did not give up easily. She showed her spirit through the end. Nikki did not go gently into the night. Through her will to live, she left you signs. And that turned into evidence to bring her justice. Don't ignore her efforts. To tell you the truth about her murder, she fought to live, but her fight also gives you answers. Don't let her struggles have been in vain. Allow Nicole to guide you on the path to find the truth, which will lead you to the clear conclusion that George Birch is guilty of this murder beyond all reasonable doubt. We ask you to return a verdict of guilty. for first-degree intentional homicide.
In his closing arguments, defense attorney Lee Shuhart said the state failed to tell the jury about the arrest of Doug Dietrich, an important fact in the case.
The facts show you that Doug Dietrich committed this crime. Justice for Nicole is not going to be delivered by a wrongful conviction of George Birch. Doug Dietrich had the motive, the opportunity, and the connection to this crime. Now, when the state talked to you about the motive that George Birch would have, that's completely fabricated. It's brought out of thin air. You didn't hear any evidence to provide a reason why George would commit it, so they had to make it up. You heard strong reasons why Doug Dietrich would commit this crime. Nikki had a voice on May 20th and May 21st. And remember those text messages. Remember what she was telling Doug Dietrich as their fight was just beginning.
Attorney Shuhart said Doug purposefully waited to report Nikki as missing to police. He said eyewitness testimony can be more important than GPS data, which is not always reliable. Shuhart said George Birch is a hard worker, loving father, and showed real emotion when he got on the stand. George knows it was wrong to not come forward right away, but that doesn't mean he's guilty of this crime, he said.
George Birch explained that he was having consensual sex with Miss Vanderhyde, that he had to carry her body to that field. That explains why his DNA was on Nicole. Now, why was George Birch's DNA on that cable? George took the stand. He didn't try to guess at it or try to explain it to you because he couldn't. Because he was knocked out. He stayed consistent with that. You would think if he was trying to make up this elaborate story, he would have come up with some sort of explanation to everything. He didn't even try. Because he didn't need to. He didn't know. He testified truthfully.
In their rebuttal, the state called George's testimony nonsense and fiction. The jury was then sent out to deliberate. After more than 3 hours, they reached their verdict.
The verdict reads as follows. We, the jury, find the defendant, George Stephen Birch, guilty of first-degree intentional homicide, is charged in the information. It is signed by our foreperson and dated this first day of March, 2018.
Nikki's family let out a gasp while seated in the gallery. There were tears and hugs as they heard George Birch was guilty of Nikki's murder. The jury was dismissed and the court proceeded to sentencing. Doug Dietrich's mother, Diane, presented the last photo of Nikki, Doug, and Dylan taken together. Doug didn't speak at the sentencing, but provided a statement that said in part, he's most worried about the impact Nikki's murder will have on their son. Judge Zukowski said that the death penalty had long been abolished in the state of Wisconsin, but had it been on the books, this case surely would have qualified for it.
You picked her up. She was walking on the street and you picked her up. She got into your car because she needed a ride. She wanted to get home. And maybe at that point, she wasn't really keen on seeing Mr. Dietrich, but she wanted to get home to Dylan. She wanted to get home to her six-month-old son. A simple request, and it cost her her life because of what you did. Protection of the public is extremely important in this case as well.
Judge Zukowski said there had to be good somewhere in George Birch, but struggled to explain how he was able to murder Nikki, drop her body in a field, and go fishing without a care in the world. George Birch was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In July 2018, Doug Dietrich pleaded no contest to second-degree recklessly endangering safety, false imprisonment, and negligent operation of a vehicle. According to the criminal complaint, an incident between Doug and Nikki's sister occurred in February 2017, 9 months after Nikki's murder. Nikki's sister had reportedly been staying with Doug to help with their child. Nikki's sister and Doug went to a birthday party and were leaving to go somewhere else when Doug reportedly touched her leg in a sexual manner. When she denied him and told him to stop, the complaint states that he got angry, drove the car they were in at high speeds, and would not allow her to get out. He ran a stoplight and only finally let her out when she started to kick the windshield. As part of the no-contest plea deal, as long as Doug stayed out of trouble until October 21st, 2019, the felonies would be dismissed. As far as I can tell, he did just that. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the verdict? What did you make of the defense's case? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Jennifer Tintner from the Law and Crime Trial Network. Follow Jennifer on Twitter @JenniferTintner. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.